the Cosmetic Course Podcast, Episode 9. This is Adrian Richards, and today in the podcast I'm going to be talking to Ron Myers of theconsultingrooms.com. We're going to be following on our series of talking to Ron about practice management, and in this episode we're going to be talking about, you know, the best ways to greet your patients when they arrive at your practice, whether in fact they should be called patients or clients, tips to help you with the consultation, also advice on how and when to schedule their next appointments, and also how to communicate with your patients or clients between appointments. We're also going to discuss measures to help you record your patient retention rate and advice about what the average patient retention rates are through the industry. Towards the end of the podcast, we're also going to give you some useful tips, and these are principally a really good online survey service where you can ask your patients how they felt about the treatment in your clinic, and also a email program which I've been using, you know, very successfully in the last few months, which allows you to communicate easily with your patients via email. So we're going to go straight into the podcast and the recording with Ron. So I'm here today with Ron Myers, again from the consulting room, who we've talked to before. So thank you for joining us today, Ron.
That's fine, Adrian.
I thought today perhaps we could go through, we've talked a bit about, you know, how you get patients to your door. I thought perhaps today we could talk about, once they're at your door, how, you know, do you treat them, the consultation, retention, and those sort of issues. So could I first start, Ron, you know, if someone walks into the clinic, what should happen to them ideally?
Well, ideally, they should be greeted with a happy, smiling face from your frontline staff and receptionist perspective, who then is going to tell them that, you know, what's actually going to be involved in their visit at the clinic, certainly to reinforce the fact that the appointment's on time and that the practitioner is expecting them, so they know that they're not just kind of, you know, told to sit over there and wait for the doctor, which can happen in some situations. So they feel welcome, they feel informed, and they feel comfortable, which is really the first impression that you want to give them.
And a nice cup of coffee or something?
Yeah, absolutely, a nice cup of coffee, you know, some biscuits if you've got them as well, you know, just to make people feel comfortable, because I think some people as well can feel a little bit afraid. If it's the first time they come into this type of business, they're unsure as to what to expect. And certainly a lot of people's situations or discussions with a doctor before or a surgeon would have been in the NHS, which I think can be a very different scenario.
And I think it's also good to get your receptionist or whatever just to check the details, that the email's right, the mobile phone number's right at that stage.
Absolutely. And for every return visit as well, it's a good idea, because people certainly do change email addresses in particularly frequently. And if you've got any newsletter route of contact, you want to make sure that that email address is live and current.
And to also ask them if they're happy for you to use that email.
Of course, yes. I mean, I think when you've got some form of check-in form where people put down their details initially, you would need to gain some form of, like a tick box or some form of commitment that it's okay for that email address to be used to communicate with them.
Yeah. And I know something I'm not very good at is, you know, keeping the wait time to a minimum.
Well, that's right. It is difficult. Sometimes, you know, people come in late, that can be a problem, so it puts the whole clinic back. But it's certainly something that I think you need to be aware of, and this isn't like the NHS where people may be prepared to wait half an hour or an hour for an appointment. You know, people are here, they're coming to buy a service, and so I think, especially nowadays as well, people expect people to be on time if they come and you know, for an appointment at a specific time and date.
Yeah, so I know that, I mean, I unfortunately often keep people waiting, you know, sort of quarter of an hour, half an hour, unfortunately. And when I went for a medical recently, I was hopping up and down after 10 minutes. So,
yeah.
You know, so try and keep it on time.
And that's why the cup of coffee and the biscuit,
yeah,
you know, can help to just sort of, you know, relax people and you know, take up that quarter of an hour. And you know, and if the receptionist isn't busy, maybe the receptionist can sit down and just have a quick chat with them as well, and tell them a little bit more about the clinic, the business, and what you're doing.
Yeah, something I'm thinking of doing, Ron. I'd be interested in your views on this. I'm going to get some iPads for the office and do little presentations, so they can sit there and watch, you know, a presentation, you know, to keep, you know, about the, about a particular treatment. So if it's Botox, they can learn a little bit about that just by watching the screen.
That sounds a great idea, actually. I really like that. And I think as well, you know, using new technology as well that has this, that a lot of people are aware of, and it's a great technology as well. As long as the media format that you're using is clear and professional, I think that's a fantastic idea.
Yeah, so no dirty fingerprints on the iPad.
Well, that's right, yes, and obviously that whatever you're showing them as well is, you know, coherent and kind of makes sense.
Brilliant, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so then they go through to see the doctor. Would you recommend you go out and greet them and bring them in?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's more personal, and you know, it's another thing as well that you can smile, eye contact, shake their hands. All those things are really important just to establish that initial good impression and initial rapport, really, with someone.
And obviously introduce yourself. So, I mean, what I say is, hello, I'm Adrian Richards, I'm a plastic surgeon, nice to meet you. Now, I never know what my first question should be. So I tend to say, is it all right if I ask you a few questions? Is that a good thing to say, Ron, or not?
I think so, yeah. I mean, people are coming for different reasons. They can be a little bit uptight. And really what you're trying to get to, obviously, is to find out why they're there, really. Yeah. Hopefully you will have been given some information as well. And it's a good idea if you can get a fairly comprehensive kind of like check-in sheet that gives you an idea as well when you're sitting there discussing with them what they're looking for. So in other words, why they're there, whether it's, for hair removal, for instance, or whether it's for breast implants or whatever, so you've got some sort of idea, and also any medical potential medical contraindications or things that you might want to check through to discuss with them. So that's a good idea. It can help to shorten the process, but the first thing is to establish what their need is, and possibly also why now, why at this sudden point in their life, because normally there'll be some form of trigger as to why they decided to come and seek this, cosmetic treatment, cosmetic improvement at this point in time. And you'll get to something maybe a little bit deeper in terms of their motivation and understand why they're there a little bit more.
Okay, so I think, going back, Ron, so I think that's right. So if they fill in a form, which sort of tells you their medical history, allergies, where they come from, those sort of things, you've got a little bit of background on them, so perhaps get your receptionist to bring that through, read it, a little bit about them, perhaps if they've got a medical condition, before you start talking to them. So at the consultation, someone's coming in, how long do you think the initial consultation should be?
Anywhere from half an hour upwards, really. I think half an hour is a minimum. When you're looking at the private marketplace for a consultation, it depends on the procedure, and it depends on how much information you require from them in order to make a decision as to whether they're suitable or not.
Okay, Ron, so just a question, sorry to interrupt you, but should you charge for this consultation?
I think it depends on what treatment you're offering. If you're a surgeon who's offering a cosmetic surgical procedure, I would say definitely yes. I would say that also if you're an experienced practitioner and you're operating in more what I would call the premium part of the marketplace with injectable treatments, I would suggest that you charge as well. And it can be a nominal fee of £50 that could be reimbursed if somebody goes ahead with the treatment. So in other words, taking off the initial treatment price. But I think that way then people will value the time that they have, and you'll also avoid some time wasters that you might pick up if you offer your time for free as a medical practitioner.
I think it also probably depends a little bit where you're working. So I sort of work in Harley Street and also in the sort of leafy shires, and I definitely notice that I get more people in London who would have come to see three or four surgeons. So there's an argument for charging for that time because you may not do the procedure. But out in the shires, it's very rare that they've seen anyone else. So there perhaps is an argument for not charging there.
I think it also depends on your local competition. If everyone else is offering free consultations, potentially that make it a little bit more difficult to attract potential customers if everyone literally is offering free consultations. But I would say on the whole, really, if you're trying to operate in the premium part of the marketplace, then I think in some way it does add value to you as a business that you value your time and the advice and the information that you're going to give to that person, and that they probably feel as well that you're more likely to be able to give, say, quality advice and information rather than just bringing them in to sell them a treatment. Some of the commercial groups, like Transform, work on this basis, but they don't see a doctor initially. They'll see a sales counselor who'll be a non-medical person who is trained basically to sell those services and procedures that company offer.
And you've told me before the quote by John Ryan. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that model was put together back in the late 70s, really to look at breast implants as they were coming through. And John Ryan felt that surgeons couldn't sell, and so what he wanted to do was to put in trained salespeople who would be able to get a higher consult to treat rate. That's essentially it, using sales communication skills.
I mean, does that work, Ron? Because, I mean, as doctors, we're rather anti-sales, aren't we?
I think that the communication process and how you go through it and the words that you use and the ability to be able to be able to get a good rapport with someone, find out what they need, and then present your solution in a compelling way, is a skill set. And I think that trained salespeople will generally get a higher conversion rate than somebody who isn't trained. So yes, I think it does work.
Okay, so although it goes against the grain for most doctors, perhaps we should do some form of sales training to increase our skills.
So, well, that's right. I think it's for me. I mean, I know selling can be seen as a bit of a dirty word, but in some essence, what you're doing, you're helping someone with a want or need to find a solution, really. And that's essentially it. Somebody's coming in with a problem, and you're trying to help them with the services that you can offer.
That makes it sound better, doesn't it, Ron?
It does. And if you truly believe, as most doctors do, that they're the best person to provide that solution. If they feel it's medically from a point of view of having no medical contraindications or whatever for that particular person, and they're suitable for that procedure, then yeah, absolutely. Then they shouldn't be walking out without a very good reason for not booking in, for a treatment with you.
Okay, just going back a bit, Ron. Before the day before they come in, it probably is good for them to get a text, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, eClinic and some of the software can do this automatically for you as well to remind them that their appointment is due. And I would suggest maybe a couple of days before, preferably.
Yeah.
Just in case they are going to cancel for whatever reason. And then at least you've got a day maybe to fill that slot rather than just doing it the night before.
Yeah, and a nice sort of friendly message. We're looking forward to seeing you, and your practitioner will be this. And then if it's someone coming back, some people I know send specific texts also, so while you're in, why don't you ask about our new range of sunblocks or something?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Again, these are all ways of communicating other services that you can offer that a client may not be aware of. They may not be aware that you sell very high quality sunblocks, and so if you prime that before, it's likely that they may, ask something about that to the receptionist or the practitioner.
Great. So, Ron, what are your views? So, a new patient, are they patients or clients?
Well, that's an interesting point. I guess from a medical perspective, you would call them patients. From a service perspective, I would call them clients. Predominantly, I think, because patients have a connotation of somebody who has maybe a medical condition, some form of illness, rather than somebody who's coming with a pot of money where they're electing for cosmetic improvement or enhancement of some form or another. Also, I think if somebody comes in with a patient mentality, potentially I think it does put them at a psychological disadvantage as well. So if they come in thinking, I'm the patient and you're the doctor, You can understand the communication route there could be different from somebody coming in saying, you know, I'm someone who has a choice here of different practitioners. I want to buy cosmetic enhancement improvement, and I'm seeking the best person for me to do that with. So I look at it more as a kind of like, you know, if you're going to go and see a solicitor, you'd be a client. I personally think that it's better to communicate like that rather than calling them patients.
Okay, well, I still can't get away from the patients, but I suppose I should try.
I think it's just absolutely drilled into the mentality. And in the clinic that we operate as well, the doctors in there, you know, always call them patients because it's just the reflex action. But in the literature that's sent out, the literature and the words and also the wording on the website talks more about clients than patients.
Yeah. So try and rid yourself of the patient word. Now, this is a contentious issue. If someone comes in, this is the first time you've ever seen them. Yeah. Should you treat them on the day?
Well, I think there's some clear guidelines there. Certainly, if it's any form of surgical procedure, then there is a required calling off period. I think that you know, the CQC would look at and potentially enforce. I think that's about 2 weeks, 14 days.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. If you're looking at injectable treatments, I think that the decision-making process needs to be less considered, and I think that probably the majority of practitioners would treat if that client or person, patient, whatever you want to call them, wants treatment there and then, and if they're suitable.
So I think it does vary. If someone's perhaps had treatments before elsewhere, it's Botox, they know what's involved.
Sure.
Perhaps it's okay. But if, you know, someone's never had treatment before, they don't really understand, yeah, you know, the difference between dermal fillers and Botox, perhaps there's more of an argument for giving them the information and getting them to come back.
Well, that's right. I think it will vary between individuals. And you'll be able to, I think experienced practitioners will understand that as well and get a feeling for how much the person understands, and certainly, you know, if you're thinking about it from a consent process as well, you need to make sure they really do understand the risks as well as the upsides. And of course, all they're thinking of is the end result in terms of how whatever condition they've got is going to be improved, and some people don't necessarily take enough time to look at the potential downsides. And you know, you really need to make sure that they understand that. And if you feel that somebody hasn't really grasped that in a consultation process, then you may want to give them, you know, a week or so to read through your consent information in more detail.
Absolutely. So we're going to talk about the clinical issues in other podcasts with clinicians, but just, yeah, suffice to say, I'm sure you'll agree with me, that the treatment should be as painless and as pleasant as possible. So having needles injected into you is never the most comfortable thing, but that, you know, using things like bacteriostatic saline and, you know, Emla can really make it much more tolerable. So once they've had the treatment, Ron, you know, and they finish the thing, how do you sort of follow them up and further appointments, and what are your views on that?
Well, I would certainly recommend if they're a new client, especially for injectable treatments as well, that you book them in for a 2-week follow-up appointment, and you review and assess and look at what the initial outcome is, how happy they are, and then use that opportunity then to reinforce the fact that this is not a one-off treatment, and that in order to maintain the results that they're happy with, which will eventually wear off, that they're going to need to book in for another appointment, and use that as an opportunity to book in for another appointment 3 months or 4 months down the line with Botox, or obviously longer for fillers, depending on the area where you've treated them.
So when they leave the clinic, do they get another appointment given to them, Ron?
Absolutely. Without a doubt, if you can get an appointment booked in 3 to 6 months in advance, that is the ideal.
Yeah. Okay, so you'd book them for an appointment in 2 weeks, and then perhaps, you know, a 3-month period. Do you phone them, recommend that, or to see how they're getting on, or some sort of communication or text?
Well, I think that, again, you know, if you can build this into a system, the more touch points you have with someone, the better they're going to feel, I think, about you and your service. And, you know, if you can build in that somebody phones them the day after an injectable treatment, just to, you know, a quick courtesy call just to say, hi, just want to make sure you're okay. You know, that there's been no concerns or whatever, and for the vast majority of people, of course, there won't be. And just to reaffirm the fact that we're looking forward to seeing you again in a couple of weeks, where we can see, hopefully, you know, the initial results of the treatment.
Yeah, and just a little tip that I found: if you get them back for the 2 weeks and you say it's for a Botox top-up or a potential top-up, people feel that they would like a top-up, and you end up giving a lot of top-ups, whether they need it or not. So it's probably best to say it's, like you said, Ron, it's to check everything's okay, to assess the area, but don't mention...
No, I would certainly avoid that word in any of your literature or any verbal communication. It's an initial assessment that you'd like to make as a practitioner, because it's the first time you've seen this person, and obviously, you know, there is a skill element to this in terms of being able to judge with an individual exactly how much Botox they need because of the areas they're being treated and the power of their muscles, and it can be difficult initially to get that right. And I think, you know, that should also be discussed in the initial consultation, is to say that the first treatment is really, you know, to look at a baseline treatment for you. We'll then look at what results we get, and then I will then be able to amend and hopefully improve on that in the next treatment set that we have.
Yeah. So again, so we've got top-ups, a word we don't like. Patient, we prefer client. The other two that I think you should try not to use are the P word, which is a paralysis.
Freeze.
So what you're not aiming to freeze everything or paralyze everything. You just aim to weaken overactive muscles. And the other one is droop. So a dropped brow, you know, droopy brow, droopy eyelid. It's better to use you know, totic. You know, PT, OTIC. So you know, brow ptosis rather than brow droop. Okay, Ron, so just moving on. So the patient's now left, they're going to come back in 2 weeks. Now, for Botox in particular, you know, I've heard people say they put you on a 14-week scheme, a 16-week scheme, a three-month scheme, a four-month scheme. When do you recommend that people should be seen again?
Well, I would say probably ideally anywhere between the kind of 3 to 4 month window.
So is it better to do it in weeks? So three months is what sort of...
So you're looking at 12 to 16 weeks, really. So you're looking at maybe trying... Because obviously from an appointment point of view, and again, depending on if people are on holiday or whatever in 12 weeks' time, you know, you want to be looking and saying, well, let's take it from 12 weeks and then look at the next available date that you have and that our practitioner has to see you for the next treatment.
And some people, I know, with Botox in particular, do lengthen that period slightly. So they might start off in 14 weeks, but then they go to 16, you know, because as the Botox takes effect, the muscles get smaller, you need less Botox.
Yes.
And probably it does last a bit longer.
Yes, I mean, there's certainly clinical evidence for that as well. So I think, again, it depends on the practitioner, their experience, and, you know, from their perspective, they need to tailor that program to the individual person. So it's up to the practitioner, I think, to tell the receptionist or tell the client to book in and the receptionist in however many weeks they feel is going to be best for their next, you know, next appointment for treatment.
Okay. Just moving on, Ron, so... Patient retention is very important. You don't, you know, with 100, 200 current patients, you know, that's probably enough to keep you quite busy, really, if your retention's good. So any comments on, you know, the retention?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, and the whole service point and how they're handled when they come into the business is key from retention point of view. If you feel they're not valued in any way, shape or form, and of course, if they feel they haven't had the type of treatment or the results that they felt they were looking for, retention is going to be difficult. So that's why I think that two-week checkup is a very good thing to do, because it gives you an idea from a technical perspective as to how you're performing. You know, are you delivering the results that these people are expecting? So either there's a technical issue in terms of your training, if you're not delivering the results, or you're having adverse events, or there could be a communication issue in terms of you're not communicating effectively the outcome of this particular treatment to this client, so they're unhappy.
Yeah.
So I think that is important. The other thing then is looking and saying, well, okay, 3-4 months down the line is quite a long time. So should we be looking at communicating with them in between? And I would definitely say yes.
How would you do that?
Well, you look at e-newsletters, which would be probably be one of the ideal routes. So if you have an email address from them and you have their consent to send them information, then you can send them information that might be pertinent to the treatment that they're having, and or look at other things that you're doing in the clinic or the business. So it may be a new treatment that you've launched. It may be an award that you've had. It may be some additional training that the staff have had that allows them then to treat other areas of the face or body with certain treatments. It could be a whole number of things. But I think the more you communicate with people, the better.
Yeah. And just one point, I think, email newsletters is keep them really short.
Yes. Short and frequent. Some people would recommend weekly. And certainly direct marketeers would recommend almost, even like weekly tips. And so some of that is mixed with information, useful information, and or offers or, certain open evenings or whatever other information that you want to kind of put out there to communicate with people.
Yeah, I mean, weekly I get some weekly ones and I'm not sure whether I like them or not really, Ron.
Well, this is it. I think it's, I'm looking at what some of the people that really look at direct email marketing advocate. I think it does depend on the market.
Can I just say, Ron, that your excellent newsletter, which I do enjoy getting, comes out monthly?
It does indeed, yes. And for us with that, we think that's probably about right. But again, that's quite a weighty letter. That's around 20 pages. So it depends on whether you want to kind of break the information down into smaller bite-sized chunks and deliver it more frequently, or whether you want to, give a weightier amount of information on a less frequent basis.
Yeah.
I think physical newsletters are good as well. So it can be, an A5 four-page physical newsletter they get in the post that can inform them again of, new treatments, new products, any offers, any open evenings that you're running, new staff, all those kinds of things. You can inform people with a newsletter, and I think that also is important as well, that somebody gets something physically in the post.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, so what sort of percentages do you think people should aim for with retention?
Well, I think it's a very difficult thing to answer, because ideally, obviously, they want 100% retention rate. In practice, that doesn't happen for various reasons. I think with injectable treatments, you're probably looking at somewhere around the sort of the 70 to 80% being a realistic target to achieve, certainly within the first year.
So just to say, so a new patient, so what, yep. What do you actually measure? The number of new patients you get who are coming back to see you a year later?
Absolutely. So if you've got a new Botox client, you treated them for the first time, and you want to be still treating them, obviously, in a year's time, hopefully. But there are undoubtedly some people that will drop off for various reasons, and that could be a very valid reason that they move from the area. It could be that they suddenly can't afford it for whatever reason, so they lost their job or whatever. So there are some very practical reasons why you're not going to get 100% retention rate. But I think you should be looking at that 70 to 80% retention. So somebody coming in, so you've got 100 people coming in for this month for Botox, you're hoping that you're getting between 70 and 80 of those still coming back in a year's time.
Brilliant. And some people I know you've talked about before, is it using sort of loyalty cards or membership schemes to help do the retention?
Yes. I mean, membership schemes is one area. If you could tie that into some form of, you can put these at different amounts as well. So you could have a very low cost entry level membership scheme, say at $9.99 a month, where people get 2 microdermabrasions bundled into that when they want. They get 10% off skincare, and then maybe an annual professional skincare MOT analysis, whether that's with a Woods lamp, if that's all you've got, or whether it's with some form of more sophisticated skin analysis software like the Vizier or Bovisage or whatever, where you can take very good photographs and look at what's happening beneath the skin as well. That also provides an opportunity for you to look at improving the revenue per client as well with retail lines, because pretty much every woman that's coming into the clinic, and increasingly men now as well, will be putting some form of cream on their face.
Yeah.
And it provides an opportunity for you to be able to look at whether or not that cream is really, you know, making any difference or not, or whether you can provide a more active skincare program for them.
Are many clinics using the sort of membership schemes effectively?
There are a number that are using membership schemes. I'm not sure how effective they are. I think, like anything, it needs to be communicated effectively and sold, in essence. And it just depends on how good they are at doing that. The benefits, I think, are that you can get a repeat revenue coming through every month, which is nice.
Yep.
You are looking at tying people into you from a loyalty perspective. So, you know, if they're coming for this membership scheme and they're getting 2 microdermabrasions a year, that's also another opportunity for, you know, for you to discuss more about the service that you can provide, and maybe they've got a thread vein or whatever forming, or they've got some veins on their legs that you can deal with sclerotherapy or with an IPL or a laser. So, you know, all of these are touch points and opportunities to increase the revenue from that particular client on an annual basis.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, other things you can do. I mean, this might be a bit cheesy, but people have told me, you know, they send birthday cards to a patient with a voucher or a Christmas card. Is that too cheesy?
I don't think so. I mean, I think maybe the Christmas card possibly is. I think you would only send them something if you were going to offer them something. So I think they're more effective as a marketing tool if you send it to them on, I think, probably their birthday and say, you know, just want to say happy birthday. And, you know, if you want to come in for a microdermabrasion, here's £20 off or something like that.
It always makes me feel better, because there was there was a famous footballer, Stan Collymore, and
yes,
he got very depressed because he only got 6 birthday cards. So I always look out for, I rarely get more than 6, actually, but it is nice to get some recognition on your birthday.
Well, I would say that birthdays are probably, because it's a much more personal thing, and I would agree with you, I think people get less birthday cards than they do Christmas cards.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're more likely to be noticed if you send a birthday card than you are if you send a Christmas card. And also lots of companies send these kind of corporate, you know,
yeah,
Christmas cards. And, you know, if you've got something really put, the more personalised you can get it, the better, really.
Yeah. Should you put, you know, sort of now you're 50 on the birthday card?
It depends on the client and how well you know them.
Yeah, I don't think that's an ideal thing to put on. So don't mention their age, but
I think, I mean, if you have a very good relationship with someone, you kind of, you can put a bit of tongue-in-cheek type of thing, humour into that, then, you know, that may work very well. If you've got somebody who, you know, gets more and more depressed as each year goes by,
yeah,
you know, they're that type of person, then I don't think that would be a good idea. So,
no.
Again, the more tailored you can get your marketing and the more personalised the message, the more effective it's going to be. But, of course, that takes time and sensitivity in terms of looking at being able to personalise that message.
Yeah.
And that depends on your setup and, you know, the information you gather and the capability that you have, the staff have, in terms of being able to get all of those things out in a timely manner.
Okay, I mean, that's great, Ron. I'd just like to ask you one last question before we finish today. Questionnaires, should you send patient questionnaires?
I think that you should definitely try to get some form of feedback from every client. So whether that's certainly if that's after any form of major cosmetic surgery procedure.
Yeah.
Because again, you want to know and understand how they felt about the whole process, and that can be right from, you know, the receptionists and how they felt they were handled from that point of view, through to the work up towards the operation, the procedure, the actual procedure, what they felt about that, and then the post-treatment recovery and the eventual outcome, because that then gives you an insight into all those different processes that a client comes through when you may only see a couple of little bits of that as a surgeon in terms of the consultation and the operating theatre and perhaps the nurses follow up with the post-op, you know, sort of recovery side of things. I think if you're looking at injectable clients, then what I would try and to do is to look at evaluating people after they've been using your services for a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a good length of time. They might have had 3 or 4 Botox treatments or a couple of filler treatments. And again, it's a good idea to get, you know, an idea about what they feel about your service.
And I just say that there's a very good online service called SurveyMonkey.
Yes.
So it's Survey, S-U-R-V-E-Y, Monkey, which is a really, actually most questionnaires that you receive now come from SurveyMonkey. It's very easy to set up, isn't it, Ron?
It is, and that's a very nice online route that also allows you to, I think, look at the information as a whole and, you know, more easily kind of assess areas where there might be concerns or problems in your business. So I would agree with you. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, so we're a great friend of SurveyMonkey, and its sister company is called MailChimp, which is an email sort of program which we use and I think is brilliant. So I would recommend anyone has a look at it. Have you had an experience with that, Ron? Or?
I'm not MailChimp. I haven't heard of that. It's a great name, though.
It is. It's great. I would. We've looked at Aweber and Pure360 and a lot of the other ones, but MailChimp is inexpensive. Actually, if your email list size is less than 500, it's completely free.
Well, that's very good. That's a great way to learn about how to use that type of, as you say, automated email software.
So tip of the day, Ron, go and look at SurveyMonkey and MailChimp. Brilliant. So, Ron, always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for joining us.
And with you, Adrian. Thank you.
And perhaps we'll continue this conversation in a couple of weeks.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye.
So, thank you very much to listening to the podcast. As I mentioned before, you can listen to the podcast by going to the cosmeticcourses.co.uk website. Alternatively, you can subscribe to the podcast so you automatically are alerted and get new episodes via iTunes. And this is also available on the website if you press the subscribe button on the website, and also if you subscribe in iTunes. We'd really appreciate it if you could leave any comments and ratings in iTunes. I would also love it if you could give us some feedback about the podcast, if you'd like me to discuss any other topics, interview anyone else you know, who you think could add valuable information. Please let me know. So again, thank you for listening, and we hope you'll be able to join us next time.